everyone. My name is Aarti, and this is the Mahabharata. Episode 62. Two Women, Two Trees, and a Man with an Axe. Also available online at www.themahabharatapodcast.com or facebook.com/themahabharatapodcast. In our last episode, we were all about water, and we concluded with the story of an innocent young man being seduced by a charming young courtesan. Last aerial shots had him running away from home, girl leading, he following, onto a cleverly crafted boat which spirits them swiftly away to the kingdom of Anga. Now, I know what you're thinking. It's a great story, but why all the subterfuge? Granted, your kingdom's suffering from drought, but why not just go knock on the Rishi's door and invite him for a visit? We're reasonable people. I know if you knock at my door and ask to borrow my teenage son, I'd be... Okay, never mind. Hearing news of the arrival, the King of Anga swings into action. He spent the last year creating a lush ashram in his land of drought, diverting every drop of water to the project. It's a gamble and a potentially catastrophic one, risking widespread starvation and death. So now he's desperate for success and praying for a return on his potentially calamitous investment. Situated on the riverbank, the little oasis is a delight to the senses, all fruit, budding flowers, and swans paddling lotus ponds. As the ship docks, a welcome party awaits. Rish is greeted by what one can only assume is a Miss Universe pageant, bevies of women, each more dazzling than the other, in an assortment of alluring garb. He practically leaps off the boat. No sooner does he touch land than the sky is suddenly open. Thunder rolls and lightning crackles. The clouds heave with weight to the deluge of a century. The entire kingdom is awash in water. In utter disbelief, people emerge into the streets and dance. Children sail paper boats. Unemployed weathermen race back to their studios. And joy returns to the kingdom of Anga. As the thirsty earth drinks deeply of the monsoon and the people weep with relief, the king gives his young daughter Shanta in marriage to the Rishi Rish. Back at the ranch, things are not nearly as rapturous. Rish's father returns home to find his ashram empty. "Dear Dad," he reads Rish's note, "please don't be upset. I've gone to find my friend. I don't know where he is, but I must be with him. Whatever the rules of his school, I'll observe them with him. Having met him once, I cannot live without him. Signed, your loving son, etc." Note in hand, the father's paralyzed into place. Smoke begins to emanate from his pores. His eyes turn bloodshot. Scraggly hair long to his waist bristles with rage. Sucking in a big gulp of air, right there, he sits to meditation. With laser focus, his mind scans through corridors of the world, searching every lane, byway, and cranny. Soon he sees the full scene. The King of Anga, the clever ashram ship, the courtesan, and the young girl who seduced his son. His eyes open. He rises. Taking a concrete jackhammer, he heads into the basement and starts digging. Rubble flies left and right as he persists with grit jaw till he hits a metal trunk. Brushing away the dirt, he opens it to reveal a deadly cache of military-grade armaments, RPGs, automatic assault rifles, handguns, rocket launchers. Then, "Oh, that's John Wick? Oops, wrong story. We were in... let me see." Right, he picks up his staff. He's going to obliterate the kingdom of Anga. What follows next, Anderson, is a study in diplomacy. the CNN reporter marvels. The King of Anger is now being invited to the State Department to give lectures. In the spring, he's expected to address the UN on conflict resolution. It sparked renewed hope for the intractable problems of our time, Israel-Palestine, Kashmir. Anticipating the fury of the hoodwinked father, the King of Anger launches a program of pacification. The journey to the capital of Anger takes several days. Everywhere the father stops, he's greeted with obsequious courtesy. Farmers offer him food, the wealthy, homes for rest. From the window of his B&B, compliments of the house, he's told, he surveys the fields around and asks the host, "Whose land is this?" Courteously, the host informs him, "Oh, this belongs to the Rishi Rishyasringa." "What?" The father's shocked. "Are there two Rishi Rishis?" But no. All this land, the host continues, and the neighboring and all adjacent to that, as well as the livestock, the mansions, the entire district, in fact, belongs to Rishi Rish. The father's very confused. How's that possible? His simple, naive child from the forest? Is this identity theft? But no. Everywhere he goes, he receives the same answer. "Are you the proprietor of this inn?" "Oh no, I would never presume. That's Rishi Rish." "Who's the CEO of this bank?" "Oh, that's Rishi Rish. Such a head for business." "Apple? Rishi Rish. Malbok Castle? Rishi Rish." The father's amazed and gratified. By the time he arrives at the capital of Anger, he's heard so much praise of his son, his wealth, his generosity, the people's warm regard, that his rage has all evaporated. The king greets him with humility at the city gate and escorts him to his son, seated now on a resplendent throne with his wife Shanta for company. The father's heart melts. "Bless you both. Be fruitful and prosperous. Give the king all that he desires. Once you have a son, come home with your wife. I'll be waiting for you." The Pandavas continue their travels. They hike to the ocean along the tributary of the Ganga and bathe in the waters of the delta. From there, they swing westward and meet up with some famous sages, as well as a disciple of one special figure named Ram Jamadagnya. Let's call him RJ for short, who'll tell us about his master's story. And what a story it is. So let's hear about RJ today. If you're a student of the Mahabharata, we'll give him a 4 on our must-remember scale. If, on the other hand, you're just here for a good time, let's give him a 1. Since he's not a major participant in the Pandava Kaurava tale. Those of you familiar with Hindu lore may have heard of a character nicknamed Parshuram, literally Ram with the axe, to distinguish him from Prince Ram of Ayodhya, who, you know, was not axe-wielding. RJ is so called for his signature implement, the axe. I carry a nail file, you carry a Swiss Army knife, he sports an axe. You never know when you need one, right? And let's just say he puts his axe to diverse use, least of which is chopping firewood. So who is he and why do we care? Let's see. There you are, first day on the job, a rookie director on the board of heaven. You're excited to begin your new assignment. You're on the subcommittee on admissions and you've always been curious how these things happen. 9 a.m., you open the door to the boardroom and see a motley group dressed in white, seated around a long mahogany table. In the corner, beverages of choice and a pastry cart. You grab a Danish Venus dung and take a seat. There are many files to discuss, and the agenda is to have a long list established by lunch. In your pile is the dossier of one Ram, son of one Jamadagni, curiously, aka Ram of the Axe. You have to make his case, and you're confident you're prepared. "Well, he's a Brahmin," you begin, but are immediately interrupted. "A Brahmin running a martial arts academy," scoffs one committee member. Brahmins are supposed to be non-violent, aren't they? But your guy was running a veritable military school. Yes, but you're taken aback at the assault and quickly become defensive. But there's a history and a context, you see? And in fact, look at the alums of the school. I mean, some pretty serious people, right? Do you see? Bhishma, Drona, Karna. Now you're hoping nobody will notice the asterisk beside Karna's name, with the footnote, expelled without due process. As committee members roll their eyes, you try to recover your narrative. So he's a Brahmin, you start again. An axe-murdering Brahmin, asks one committee member. Nah, a matricidal axe-murdering Brahmin, corrects another. Whereupon a third interjects, a genocidal, matricidal axe-murdering Brahmin. The discussion devolves into guffaws and heckling. Look, you plead weakly, let me make my case. You don't have to agree, but what's the harm in listening, right? The harm is that we waste time when we've got 100 other files to get through, somebody points out bluntly. I promise I'll be quick, you tell them, if you don't interrupt me. Eyes roll again and the chair gestures for you to begin. You're now completely off your game, so you have to wing it. You decide to begin a couple generations prior to soften the impact of later events. Deep breath. Okay. There was a king in the city of Kanyakumja. The king of Kanyakumja, roughly modern-day Kannauj in the northern Indian state of Uttar Pradesh, is a man by the name of Gadhi. Don't worry about the names. Unless you're Bob Goldman or Adhish or Brian or another professional scholar, none of these are important for our story. King Gadhi has a gorgeous young daughter named Satyavati, not to be confused with our Pisin Bharata matriarch of the same name. Satyavati has many suitors, but one is particularly persistent, a Bhargava Brahmin named Ruchik. Again, don't worry about the names. The Brahmin is besotted and eager, so the king calls him in one day. You seem like a decent bloke, so I'm going to be straight with you. He pours two glasses of scotch and hands one to his guest. You can't afford her. In our line, we practice the custom of bride price. My daughter's bride price was set at birth and is such that likely even the Rothschilds can't afford her. You're just a Brahmin. Just tell me, pleads the Brahmin. I'll do anything. The king looks him over with pity. 1,000 thoroughbreds, pure white in color. But here's the catch. Each must have one black ear. The Brahmin gulps. Exactly. There are only so many of them in the world. Without truckloads of money, I've no idea how you'd get them. The Brahmin thinks furiously. 1,000 thoroughbreds, white, black ear. He has an idea. He knocks back his drink and sets the glass on the table. I'll be back in a week. He knows his dad, Rishi Bhrigu, is one of the most respected Brahmins of his time, with a Rolodex, including kings and gods. He decides to tap some of his dad's contacts and go straight to the god Varuna, who's known to keep the best horses. In consideration of the Brahmin's illustrious lineage, the god Varuna's obliging. They walk through the stables, picking out all the horses matching the description. You can collect your parcel at these coordinates on Earth, instructs the bursar, and hands him the requisition. Elated, the Brahmin races back, collects the horses, and for once, all goes well. Soon, nuptials are celebrated in the city of Kanyakumja. The newlyweds are super happy. They find a nice house in the burbs, set up home, and one day Rishi Bhrigu himself comes to visit. His daughter-in-law's a beautiful young woman, and he's impressed with her hospitality. I want to give you something special for a gift. Is there anything you desire? Satyavati knows exactly what she wants and speaks bashfully. All my life, my mother longed for a boy, and I too would love to have a son. Would you bless us both so we can both experience the sweet babbling of little boys? The great guru smiles indulgently. You shall both have sons. He gives her directions. At the next ovulation, each woman must embrace a tree. The mother, an oak. The daughter, a fig. What precisely is the connection between the subspecies of flora and the child to be born, he leaves mysterious. Fatefully so, because when their ovulation cycles roll around, the women embrace the wrong tree. Upon his next visit, the guru remarks upon his daughter-in-law's glow. You mixed it up, didn't you? I told you, details are important. Species have unique properties. They're not interchangeable. He sighs. Now you're going to have a Brahmin who will behave like a Kshatriya, and your mother's going to have a Kshatriya who will behave like a Brahmin, messing with the order of things. Satyavati, of course, is herself a princess married to a Brahmin, but she's very keen that her son should be a Brahmin. She's distressed. I really want a nice, pious Brahmin boy. Can you please defer this to the next generation so my grandson will be the confused one? She's so upset he takes pity on her. So shall it be. Your son will be a Brahmin, your grandson a Brahmin with a Kshatriya's temperament. Now I know what you're thinking. Brahmin, Kshatriya, does it really matter? Can a man, even a famous rishi, just wave a wand and make you one or the other? And maybe we're on the nurture side of the debate. Are people really born with immutable temperament? And which one is it? Is class determined by character or by birth? How can it be both? Well, depending on your postal code, it does matter, and it certainly matters to our text. Let's recall a lesson the lizard Ruru taught the snake-murdering Brahmin Ruru. A Brahmin supposed to be the refuge of creatures, kind, compassionate. A Brahmin's heart, lizard Ruru told us, should be soft like butter. Violence is the preserve of Kshatriyas. Our tree-hugging debacle is now messing with the order of things, with Brahmins who'll act like Kshatriyas and Kshatriyas who'll act like Brahmins. So you see, it's not his fault, you plead with the committee. He didn't have a choice. He was predisposed to violence on account of this cosmic mix-up, you see. He couldn't help it. But faced with baleful looks and harumphs of derision, you continue your story. All unfolds per Rishi Bhrigu's promise. The child born to his daughter-in-law is for all intents and purposes a sweet, pious Brahmin boy, studious, smart, adept at performing the rites. Yet he also takes up the warrior art, loves to play with weapons. Why is a Brahmin handling weapons? I don't know. It was an elective at school, probably. You can choose a language or you can choose sword fighting. What's a little boy going to pick? He chose fencing over French. It's not a crime. You're feeling beleaguered and testy. But I'm telling you, he's an outstanding hermit. He performs difficult austerities to impress even the gods, so much so that when he falls in love with King Prasenajit's daughter Renuka, the king agrees right away. No bride price hero's quest nonsense. And the two get married. You take a gulp of water and loosen your tie. Your hands are clammy and you want to open a window. They have 5 boys. Our applicant, RJ, is the youngest. He was precocious from the outset. Though the youngest, he outperformed his brothers in every sphere. Academics, sports, sheer force of will. He was sharp and determined, a visionary. Yes, a visionary, you insist defiantly. Today he'd be running Fortune 500 companies, making a killing. You immediately regret your choice of words and move on hastily. Anyway, RJ was his dad's favourite. But you see, his dad, Satyavati's sweet Brahmin boy, has grown into a strict disciplinarian as a man, a real authoritarian, domineering type. A terrible thing happens one day, but it's not RJ's fault, all right? Events just unfolded that way. His mum, Renuka, is out in the woods, going to the pond to bathe. Who should happen to be there but King Chitrarath, with his Beckham physique, ripped, muscular, sexy. He and his wives are fooling around in the pond. Bodies are bare and the action steamy, and poor Renuka becomes involuntarily aroused. It's not her fault, of course. Her husband's a stern man with a harsh temper, and it's only momentary, and who can blame her? She's starved for affection. For a moment, she thinks wistfully of what she doesn't have. But she catches herself immediately, shocked at her thoughts, and runs home trembling, frightened, knowing her husband can read minds. She hasn't done anything, but she knows to him it won't matter. If even inadvertently she's thought of another man, it's enough. And so it is. As soon as he sees her, he knows. You slut! He's practically shaking with rage. You filthy, disgusting slut! He storms at her with such fury, the elder boys come running in alarm. I want you to kill this dirty woman, he commands them. Cut off her cheating head. Destroy her so I never have to look at her face again. You, he commands the eldest. But the eldest shrinks back in horror. Then you, he orders each of his sons, or you. But they're each paralyzed into shock. You useless, pathetic, imbecile lot. He's apoplectic. I curse you. All of you will lose your wits to become like the blithering animals you are. Get out of my sight. As the boys are suddenly rendered babbling idiots drooling at the mouth, RJ comes in, fresh from his favorite sport, axe throwing. He stops short when he sees his brothers. What's going on? My son, Jamadagni turns to him, kill this wicked woman, your mother. Don't hesitate. Do it now. Cut off her head. All of 15, RJ takes his axe and swings. With one blow, he chops off his mother's head. There's pin drop silence in the boardroom. Your heart is hammering 1,000 beats a minute. Sweat is pouring down your brow. You open a window. As the decapitated corpse of his mother bleeds onto the floor, RJ and his father sit. You did a difficult thing, my son. I'm proud of you. You're the only worthy child from this mediocre litter. His father still incensed at his elder children's defiance. But as the day wears on and the two settle into their new reality, RJ is now the only functional son left, the father calms down. You know what? Ask me a wish. You deserve it. This is where he makes up for it, all right? This is where we see he's not a terrible kid. It's complicated when your dad tells you to do things. RJ seizes on the opportunity. Okay, can you bring Mum back to life? And can you make it so she doesn't remember what I did? Also, I don't want to be tainted with the sin of matricide. And please fix my brothers. That's four wishes, but who's counting? His dad sighs. Yeah, okay. He's amassed a great cache of tapas, so he can actually do this. He restores the status quo of the family. You look around the room to gauge reaction. There's a lot more to say, so you want to be sure you have them on your side. Right. Some are smirking sarcastically, others shaking their heads. Thanks for that sympathetic portrait. Now there's just a little matter of genocide. It's clear the long list will not happen by lunch, so you all take a break to regroup for part two in the afternoon. In our next episode, we'll continue the story of Ram Jamadagna, the axe-wielding Brahmin who will single-handedly exterminate the entire class of Kshatriyas. Why, you ask? And how? And what does it have to do with the Pandava Kaurava story? Let's find out next time, if you'll join me for another episode of the Mahabharata.